Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Darlitz from the Science of Psychotherapy, and I'm here with my partner in crime, Richard Hill. Howdy, Richard.
G'day, Matt. It is great to be here as the managing editor of the magnificent The Science of Psychotherapy magazine, which is always, every month, my great pleasure.
Well, I hope everybody out there has had a fantastic holiday season. We're coming into the new year, and so I hope 2020 is a fantastic year for you all.
Absolutely. And we have really two very interesting women who are doing great work who we're going to be talking to today. Fill us in.
Yes, we've got Deborah Cabanis and Yael Holeschutz from Columbia University. So we've got Deborah, who is the clinical professor of psychiatry at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons and the director of psychotherapy training in the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia there. And in that role, she teaches psychodynamic psychotherapy to residents and coordinates teaching and supervising of all the psychotherapy in the residency over there. And we've got Yael as well, who is also from Columbia University. And she's a board certified psychiatrist with experience in many different therapeutic modalities and up-to-date psychopharmacological practices. And she works in multiple treatment settings with a variety of patients, including college and graduate students and individuals with first episode psychosis.
Yeah, and these are two just really intelligent and effective people. And it's me on my own doing this one, Matt, because you weren't available. But we'll be talking with them, and it was great to be able to do that, to add to our podcast series.
Fantastic. Yes. Now, before we jump in, let me just say, if you would like to support our podcast, please head over to our site and subscribe. You can get a magazine-only subscription, which works out less than a dollar a week. So if you think that we're worth a dollar a week, and of course you have access to our magazine and all the wonderful content that's in that magazine, then we would love to have your support. So head over to thescienceofpsychotherapy.net and go to the membership tab. We'd love to have you on board.
And just have a look at our academy as well, where there's lots of learning opportunities, and it's another level in our subscription, but just check it out. It's all still terribly reasonable. But for now, we're going to go off and we're going to learn about different therapies, different people, and two fantastically interesting women.
Well, welcome to Deborah Cabanis and Yael Holeschutz. Thank you so much for joining us on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast.
Well, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And whereabouts are you in this wonderful world of ours? Deborah?
So we're both at Columbia. I've actually been at Columbia since 1984. I was a resident there and have been on the faculty there. For many years, I was the director of psychotherapy training, and I'm now one of the associate training directors in the residency training director, the residency training program there. I'm also a psychoanalyst at the Columbia University Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research. And so very much in the education world at Columbia Psychiatry.
And yes, and you sound very busy, which is fantastic. Well, wonderful work. And Yael, just quickly on you, where you're there and your work there?
Yeah, so I also am at Columbia. I graduated about 6 years ago from the residency program, and currently I work here as one of the assistant directors of the residence training clinic, which is an outpatient clinic for the third and fourth year psychiatry residents. So I supervise and teach. I also have a practice here in New York City.
Yael has led a course for us for many years on differential psychotherapeutics. So that's an important thing that relates to the book as well.
Mm-hmm. And this is the central theme that we can use in our conversation today, your wonderful book, Different Patients, Different Therapies. And as you mentioned, this idea then and formulation you have, a differential psychotherapeutics. But let's just start briefly, if we could have an introduction into what the principal ideas, the foundational idea of what the book is bringing to us.
So one of the things that has been very important to me in my career as a psychotherapy educator, particularly in psychodynamics, is really clarifying things that often aren't so clear. That's really been true in psychodynamics, really operationalizing what do we actually do. And one of the things that we really have to do is when we see any new patient or client is that we have to make a decision about what type of therapy would be best for that person. You know, just because you're a carpenter doesn't mean that everything's a nail, right? Just because you do CBT doesn't mean everybody's good for CBT. Just because you do behavior therapy doesn't mean everybody's good for behavior therapy. And we, you know, after a while, we just make referrals, or I think, you know, often we just take patients into our practice and don't think as carefully as we might about what would really optimize in terms of psychotherapeutics, in terms of what kinds of psychotherapy would be absolutely best for that person. So over the years, we've really thought about this, and we decided to write this book in which we break down step by step what somebody might do, whether that's a practiced clinician or, you know, a new student, to think about if for each individual person who comes into our office, what would really be best for this person in terms of their psychotherapy. In the land of psychiatry, there are algorithms that really help people, for example, decide what type of medication. But for us, it really hasn't been broken down in this way about how we really decide what's best for each person. And that's what we really tried to do here.
Yes, I think there's just as you introduce psychomedication that aspect, maybe there's a little interesting little metaphor, is that with medications, we titrate them according to client responses. So this is a little bit of applying that same basis, because if you reverse that idea of titration, it's saying, okay, I'm applying what is best in relation to my knowledge, but then I'm going to look and see what the client is doing. What do you feel about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is so important. And, you know, I think that so many studies have shown that the outcome is dependent on alliance and the relationship between the therapist and the patient. And we want to, you know, if the patient's response is positive, then they're likely to do better in the treatment. And so I think making sure that it's something that the patient, him or herself, wants, and that they're on board and that they understand what they're doing, and eliminating some of the mystery and really bringing the patient into the conversation in terms of informed consent, talking about other treatment options, talking about why you're recommending what you're recommending. This can really have, we think this can have a really tremendous benefit to the treatment.
Yes, I think, well, there's been a number of meta-studies enacted. Scott Miller is a person, I think, off the top of my head, who's been looking at comparative therapies and found that when you just look at the therapy itself, that there's potentially not a great deal of difference in the effectiveness. They all have an effectiveness between a vast number of different styles and types of therapies that researchers have managed to name. So this idea that there's something else that creates the effectiveness of the therapy is wonderful. And you have a particular sort of formal or a style, a set of ways of testing, differential psychotherapeutics. What's the breakdown of that, Deborah?
So, you know, what we think about is, we think about this as a cycle, and we've got four important steps here. It's very important before we start up this, as Yael says, that each one of these steps is collaborative, right? Mm-hmm. They're co-created between the therapist and the patient or client. It's the language of this is very important. We learned as we talk to people on all different types of treatments. Some people say patients, some people say clients. They're all, but we opted for patient, but clearly people talk about this in many different ways. You know, and we call this a cycle. We call this the DP cycle, the differential psychotherapeutics cycle, because you can enter this cycle at the beginning, or for example, when you think things might not be going so well, you might want to enter the cycle again to reconsider whether your initial recommendation is really, you know, continuing to work or whether you need to think about something else. And again, the language of the four steps is also very much informed by the fact that we talk to people in so many different types of treatments. Not everybody, for example, says they want to take a history. So we called our first step learning, You really have to learn about the patient. And what we try to do in the book is show all the different kinds of ways that different therapists from different types of treatments learn about the patient. So you first learn about the patient and learn about what brought them there and what their goals are, what they're interested in. Then we think. The second step is thinking about the patient. Again, sometimes that's called formulating, but formulating means different things to different people. Really, we're thinking about what's wrong, what do we think needs to change, what does the patient need to change, think needs to change, how are we conceptualizing this after learning about the patient. And then what we want to do is match what we think needs to change and what the goals of the patient are to a range of different types of treatment. So the third step is matching. Again, this isn't matching to, you know, many, many different kinds of things that any individual clinician can do, but rather matching to the range of things that are available in the environment, thinking about what the resources are in that person's community, and again, what the goals of both clinician and the patient are, and then ultimately discussing this together, thinking about how to describe this. It's learning, thinking, matching, discussing, a cycle. Very important that going into the cycle, you have to have a certain kind of stance, which we call the DP stance, which is really quite agnostic. In other words, you don't see the person and say, hope I get a good CBT case today. Rather, what am I going to learn? How am I going to think about it? How together are we going to match to optimize the treatment, and how are we going to talk about it together?
Yeah, this is something that we talk about a lot at the Science of Psychotherapy, this nature of what information is the client or the patient bringing to us, and how sensitive are we in moving past our preferential thinking and being as adaptive, and perhaps allowing that self-organization of our knowledge to function, rather than our idea of I must do this, or I should do that, or the client must do that.
Exactly.
And I do love the way the book is divided. You allude to it there a bit, but in the first part and the second part, there's wonderful work written by you and Yale. And then in the third part of the book, you turn to being editors, and there are, let me see, I think I counted 38 contributors on the different theoretical frameworks, and if I'm right, 11 of case studies. Some of them may double up. And one of the persons who doubles up a lot is you, Yale, in there doing a lot of stuff. This experience of sitting there with the patient, let me use your terminology there, and going to yourself, do you sometimes sit there saying, oh gosh, I think I'm doing the wrong thing? Or does the client bring that? What's that sort of experiential framework for the client, the patient therapist experience in your view?
So absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of this did, you know, the idea for this book came from a lot of different places, including the class that we've taught here at Columbia for over 10 years, and also our clinical experiences. I think that absolutely this book has really caused us to think a lot about and to think very sharply about what we're doing with patients and why we're doing it, and to really try to reevaluate at various points, including at initial evaluation, but then throughout the treatment. Is this working? Does the patient seem to be meeting goals? And there are short-term goals and long-term goals, but constantly paying attention to all of that, trying to reassess as much as possible and relaunch the DP cycle as much as possible throughout the treatment, in order to really determine whether, I mean, I can speak for myself, whether the treatment is going in a direction that I'm pleased with. Now, using the DP cycle in the middle of a treatment does not necessarily mean that you're gonna necessarily change course. Sometimes what happens is that it can help you understand the patient a little bit better, help you understand what's going on in the treatment a little bit better, and maybe determine that this is the right course of action, at least right now. But also, I think that doing this book and really thinking about this has led me to be a lot more open to referring people to an adjunctive treatment or considering different treatment options, or even just in asking somebody, how do you think this is going for you right now? And I think all of that information has been very, very helpful and has helped my clinical work quite a bit.
Yes, there's a lot more talk about feedback nowadays. Quite right. Deborah, yes.
No, sorry. I'm really glad that you like the format of the book, and I just wanted to give a shout out to our wonderful contributors for in the third section. Just to say, all of the vignettes that we have in the book are constructed, so they're not real people. The vignettes were written by either our students or recent students, and so each vignette is written, say, somebody about a late life depression or a postpartum depression or an OCD situation, and each one has three different therapists from a different school of therapy talking about how they would approach that particular situation. And it was just a remarkable experience getting people like Myrna Weissman, who invented IPT, and different wonderful clinicians from all different kinds of therapies to really, in their own words, talk about their thought process. What we really want to do for the reader here is get people into the minds of these expert therapists in all of these different areas to hear how they think. And also we have them then verbatim say how they would discuss this, again, to create this really collaborative spirit with their patients. So that was tremendous fun for us. We learned a lot. I hope that readers have that experience as well.
I would add to that it was so interesting and wonderful to see how on board the collaborators were and how excited they were about this project. And I think that really does speak to this project and how people from all kinds of different schools of thought or ways of working have come together, because this is something that, you know, a lot of people are thinking about and, in some ways naturally do, and applying the rubric to the work that they're already doing was something that they were very amenable to, very receptive to, and we had a lot of enthusiasm and excitement. So that made our work more interesting and fun, and it also made just the whole book really come alive.
We used the rubric because initially when we were doing the class, we had, you know, somebody would present a case and we'd have three different therapists discussing it. And we didn't get this apples to apples kind of thing. You know, in other words, one person would discuss it in one way, and one person would discuss it in another way. And we realized that the students really got more out of it when all of the therapists used the same rubric. So that's kind of how we got into thinking about using a common rubric for all of the therapists.
Yes, it's a wonderful way of going through. But from the reader's point of view, and something that I feel very strongly about, is that we need to, if not have a large number of good knowledge of special approaches in ourselves, this book also opens the therapists, the clinicians' awareness of all these other therapies, which hopefully increases their capacity to A, know what directions to increase their study, but B, know what directions to perhaps refer clients to when a client is wanting something. And exactly. And this referral process is recommended through the framework.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, it's really what we'd like people to get out of this book. We don't imagine that people are going to have the capacity to do many, many different types of treatments. I think ultimately you become good at one, maybe two. And that's that's your expertise. But part two of this book, which actually Yael took the lead on, really goes through the basics of all of these different types of treatments. And what we would like people to do is have a sense of what they're for, who might benefit from them, and so that they're open to more referrals. I mean, we learned, for example, I didn't know that much about ACT before this, and I really had such an eye-opening experience learning about ACT and have made more referrals to ACT subsequently. So I think that's an example of what we hope this book would offer clinicians.
Yes, it's been very interesting. My experience, I've been very focused in psychotherapy for the last 20 years, but actually my early life, what I call my early psychotherapy training, was as a professional actor. So I figure you kind of learn a lot about people in that frame. But one thing that I found fascinating was that there are an awful lot of psychotherapeutic and therapeutic techniques that we practice today that are given all kinds of interesting names that I can point out in Shakespeare. So there's a very humanistic framework around psychotherapeutic practices, like ACT. I don't think he actually thought about that people would be good to accept and commit, but found that when people accepted and committed, they did much better and went in and did all that wonderful work to enrich it and make the framework of it then useful in therapeutic process. And this is an interesting, it's almost like we improvise to some extent, but a good improviser in jazz piano is better when he has a lot of technique.
Yeah, you know, that's been the other books that I've written have about psychodynamic psychotherapy have really taken that stance as well, that it's not vague, it's not mushy, it's very clear. And some of the, you know, CBT and IPT started that way. But I think we can look at any psychotherapy, whether it's psychoanalysis, psychodynamic psychotherapy, ACT, whatever, as being very technique filled. People can learn them, master them, and we can evaluate them. And we try to take that operational approach here too.
Yes, it may be a bit simplistic, but if you have somebody come into your rooms and you say hello and they reply to you in French, it's a really good idea not to keep going in English and perhaps adapt some kind of French form.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think in some of the examples that you give and in your particular one in the book, that's actually how I see it. It's see if you can appreciate the language of the client as well as the language that you're capable with. Can you give us a little insight into your case study section?
Sure. So the case is about a young woman who has trouble regulating her affect, meaning she, you know, she kind of has mood swings. She'll go from feeling good about herself to feeling terrible about herself, often really dependent on how other people interact with her, how she perceives other people feel about her, think about her. This particular case we go through the kind of life story, we call it. And so we talk about her upbringing, a father that had a very, very bad temper, a mother who was depressed and really wasn't able to give her the affection or the validation that she yearned for and needed. And so that's the clinical case is that, which is something that a lot of us see in our offices all the time. And we have three different experts conceptualizing it, including Deborah Cabanis. So we have Deborah doing the psychodynamic psychotherapy approach, and she talks about, she conceptualizes it using a psychodynamic lens, talking about self-esteem issues, etc., but also points out that maybe she wouldn't necessarily recommend psychodynamic psychotherapy at this very moment because the patient really does have behaviors that are quite dangerous and may need to be better controlled. And Deborah even talks about how perhaps a psychodynamic psychotherapy would provoke some of these behaviors or be kind of difficult for this person at this time, meaning potentially unsafe at this very moment. Then we have Beth Brodsky, who's a DBT expert, who conceptualizes a case from a dialectical behavioral therapy. So she also talks about kind of the biosocial conceptualization, how somebody that had an invalidating environment growing up and maybe temperamentally had difficulty regulating her emotions may end up with this set of difficulties as an adult, and talks about how she would think about this person from a DBT standpoint and talk to this person about doing DBT, specifically initially focused on some of the riskier behaviors that she has. And finally, we have Richard Hirsch, who is an expert in transference-focused psychotherapy. And he, which is a psychotherapy that is based in psychodynamic psychotherapeutic principles, but has specifically been developed for people that have what we would say is borderline personality disorder, according to the DSM, though it's not clear necessarily. You know, we kind of didn't focus so much on DSM diagnoses in this book for a variety of reasons, but he conceptualizes from that framework and talks about how he would use all of that information to bring her into a treatment and how he would proceed with that. So it's a really common set of difficulties that we all encounter a lot, with three different expert clinicians really thinking about not just what they think about the case, but how they would actually proceed and use all that information to treat this person.
Fantastic. I love it. And Deborah, what was it like working in that sort of threesome of thinking? How did that affect you as a as a clinician in your thinking?
Well, you know, we did them. What we did is we sent them out and we did it individually. So we didn't discuss them, but it was absolutely fascinating to read them ex post facto. And I'll also say that I wasn't the only person writing in who potentially, even though I was kind of assigned to be the person, looking at this particular person through a psychodynamic lens, my first thought was really DBT. And we had that with several people. And I love that because it means that the writers who we had, who are really experts in their area, were modeling this tremendous flexibility, not only in thinking about, other types of treatments, but really focused on what the goals of the person are who is coming to consult us and what's really going to optimize their treatment.
Yes, and I'm just thinking of Milton Erickson, who was quite famous in being very adaptive and sort of responsive. But one of the things of his I really liked was saying that possibly the best therapy you do is the one that is not exactly like any other therapy that you do, because at least then you've got some feedback that you are doing something uniquely related to the client.
Well, it's interesting because we're taking a slightly different point of view in this book, which is to say that there are a lot of different evidence-based treatments. And at the moment, the best evidence that we have is that using an evidence-based treatment is optimal. I think that even we thought that perhaps we were more eclectic than we might be. But doing this book really helped us to see, for example, for me, I'm a psychoanalyst and a psychodynamic psychotherapist. And as I read, for example, Beth's treatment of that person, the way Beth would look at that person and the way Richard would look at that person, mine was really quite distinct. So it actually made me realize that I was using a very distinct set of techniques and a very distinct way of thinking about formulating the person. So I think we ended up feeling that actually we were less eclectic than we thought we were, which is kind of interesting. And again, the recommendation here is to, be really expert at what you do, really know your techniques, but know what the range is out there and be very flexible about referring to other experts who might offer the person something different.
And which is the wonderful thing about being human. We don't require only our own brain in order to function successfully in the world. In fact, we deliberately and purposefully use many brains in order to function successfully in the world.
You got it.
Yeah. So Yale, this book, to me, brings together lots of brains and makes me feel very clever. I'm only joking. I feel very supported. Is really what I feel. What was sort of one or two of your comments? I'm just thinking we're sort of coming up to a lovely half hour of discussion. As we wind up now, what are some of the frameworks or little summaries that you'd like to just present as we get towards the end?
Well, in my experience of the book, I really do agree with Deborah that I think this is really, the experience was incredibly interesting and educational. I've learned a lot about different types of psychotherapies. I've really developed a sense of what else is out there. And I've also really realized that I do practice a particular type of psychotherapy. I'm finishing up training for psychoanalysis and I do psychodynamic psychotherapy. And this has really helped me clarify my own thinking. And I think even just going back to Deborah's example of the psychodynamic psychotherapy formulation, but then not recommending it, I think it's such an important point that just because we can think of somebody a certain way doesn't mean we should necessarily practice that particular therapy for that particular person at that time. And I think for myself, that is a point that I continue to go back to as I work with people in my practice, as I evaluate new patients, as I think about myself as a developing somebody who's soon to be a psychoanalyst and is a psychoanalytic candidate at this point. It's just such an important thing. And I think that ultimately thinking that way has made me a better clinician, because I think if I can offer what I know how to offer for the people that can benefit from it, then I'm doing the job that I'm supposed to be doing, as opposed to trying to make everybody fit into the way that I think about clinical work. And it's just been incredibly rewarding and helpful in my own work and in teaching and thinking about all of these things.
Beautifully said, yeah. And Deborah, what passing, ending, and summarizing thoughts might you have?
Well, I love your conceptualization of being able to use all the brains that we can use to help a person. You know, being a psychotherapist can be somewhat lonely sometimes. You're in your office and you're seeing your patients. And while, you know, that's often the model, hopefully our book can give you some community. And to, you know, we'll bring our 38 people and you can have them in your office with you to help you create a community and to offer some more brains to help optimize treatment for your patients.
Yeah, as a summary, that's so wonderful. And it is interesting that for many people that will be a little surprising, whereas certainly as an actor and my training to become a therapist was, of course, what the other actors were doing and what the other actors were capable of, that is what made the great performance. And I think this is something that really I see being played out in the book in this academic area of psychotherapy. And I just can't thank you guys enough for being here and talking to us, but for writing this book. I think it's a really, really important book, not just a nice little book. I think it's really important. And that's why we want to do what we can at the Science of Psychotherapy to promote it.
Well, thank you so much, Richard. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And so for today, I know you're busy. I'm in another country and Matt's asleep. But I'll get back and tell him all about this later. But for now, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. We'll really look forward to hearing it.
Yes, thanks for having us.
Okay, everybody, bye for now.
Have a great day. Bye.
Wow, fantastic, Richard. What a great conversation. Sorry I wasn't there with you guys, but thank you so much for touching base with Deborah and Yale.
Yeah, watching this process of development of the understanding of that clients are need to be the ones that are central to the process or that they respond to different things. This is terrific, seeing it being approached from a lot of different angles, and the way these Deborah and Yale are approaching it and bringing in a number of other. There's a host of people who are talking about their expertise and their practices. There's a massive lot to learn from this book. It's really, really worth reading.
Absolutely. So let me just remind our listeners that this is Different Patients, Different Therapies, Optimizing Treatment Using Differential Psychotherapeutics. And this is from our friends at Norton. And I will leave a link in the show notes. Well, thanks so much, Richard. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. And we will catch you next week.
So bye from me.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.